This is Reality Proves Possibility. We can do better than this. Welcome, everyone. This is Reality Proves Possibility, and we can do better than this. And I'm honored to be here with Otto Sharma, who may need no introduction, but he has transformed the field of large system change with Theory U and works with the Presencing Institute globally with all kinds of audiences. And I thank you so much for being here with us, Otto, as a credible change agent yourself. I really appreciate this opportunity. So I wanted to check in with you. What's your response, your immediate response that that reality proves possibility and we can do better than this?
I was actually stumbling a little bit about reality proves possibility. Exactly. So what is exactly the meaning making you have? Because you can read that in multiple ways. You could even, you know, make the reverse point as well. So how is it that you're reading it?
Well, I mean, mine is that we know how to do better than we're currently doing.
Yeah.
We know, and we're a product of evolution. We have solved existential crises before. That's why we're here. We have many examples of how we can actually organize better and solve the problems that we're all facing. And we don't tend to look at what works. So in the end, many people are skeptical, cynical, etc. And that's sort of the way that I position it. But I'm just curious that how would you see it if you're saying you're seeing it the opposite?
Well, no, I mean, you could read it the other way around. So What I mean with that is this. I think kind of we both agree on the conclusion, right? Mm-hmm. So it's something else is possible. So we can do better than that. But so the way I would have probably thought about it is possibility proves reality, right? Because that's my... Honestly, that's my experience as a young person, becoming a human being, right? Really, what does that mean? And I think I remember that feeling very acutely. And I think it's even more extreme today, which is, so you come into this world, you're born into some circumstances, whatever they are. And then, you know, after a number of years, for me, it was kind of in my teenage years, right? Kind of so it wasn't actually that particularly early. It was kind of mid-late teenage years that I started to wake up. So what's actually going on around me? And then you begin to be, you know, you're more interested in what's happening society-wise. Back then, it was kind of the birth of the environmental movement and the late 1970s, the birth of the... Green movement, the Green Party, and the anti-nuke and peace movement, all this stuff. So whatever it is, it's kind of different things for different people. But the fundamental feeling I totally remember, like yesterday, which is that you look at this reality and you say, that is really strange, right? That everything is organized in this particular way. It could have been organized in so many different ways. So in other words, you see reality as the manifestation of just one. Often, I'm not sure it's an infinite number of possibilities, right? Probably there's a finiteness, right? But there's of many, many possibilities, right? It's a manifestation of one of those. But why is it not organized in a very different way, according to very different principles? That was before really the development of any deeper intellectual skills. That was a basic human reaction. I remember in my bones. I think it's kind of very human to respond. So when you come into this world, when you really look with an unbiased mind, right, kind of with an open mind into reality, you're just astonished, right? Why is everything organized that one way as opposed to a very different way? And so I think that's where my feeling is, that to me, reality is actually composed of two elements. One is what we actually see. It's the manifest reality. And the other one is kind of the potential reality. It's a field of possibility that is not infinite, right? But that is something we can... as innovators, as leaders, as change makers, and also as movements, connector. And fast forward, 30 years or something, or 20, 30 years, 15 years from that moment, when I went to MIT and started to study profound innovation and change and systems change and follow people who really brought profound change into the world in their own fields, be that technology, business, or society, or culture. The main thing I learned and I realized was exactly that, which is that those people have a very intimate connection to a possibility, right? A possible future that has no necessity, but that looks at you because it depends on you to manifest. And that for me is kind of really the fundamental insight that I stumbled into as a young person, and I stumbled again into in studying innovators, and which is the basic phenomenon of presencing, right? And I would say it's really the insight that reality is more than what meets the eye. Mm. That the most important part of change and the most important part of reality is that part that is invisible to the eye, but that you can connect with when you cultivate your deeper sensing capacities. And the most important organ of these deeper sensing capacities obviously is your heart, right? Your sensing capacity. And I think that's where a lot of the advanced leadership and the advanced learning capacities are happening or not happening.
Yeah, wonderful. Wonderful reframe. I love it. And for sure, it is about possibility and being connected to another option for humanity and for self, right? And it's sort of like that self that you anchor that in also in the present and maybe emergent future of what you're sort of experiencing as a desired reality compared to maybe the experienced one, and then shifting that in some way. Can you walk us through like how you started sharing that, how you started from being involved with the peace movement and the ecological sort of movement in a way to see the more general possibility for the humanity and the kind of change process and the work that you are famous for now. How did that originate for you? What were some of the key moments in your intellectual, but maybe also in your personal development that were sort of happening now that you look back?
Okay. Well, I would say probably three or four key moments early on. The first one is I grew up on a regenerative farm, right? And really learning from my parents who converted from conventional architecture, agriculture to regenerative agriculture. Really learning the basic principle that I just shared, which is that what is growing above the ground, what's visible to the eye is a function, the quality of that is a function of the quality of the soil, is the quality of what doesn't meet the eye, or what is less or least visible to the eye, let's put it that way. Of course, you can see it, right, when you put your hand into the soil, and that's what we do as action researchers, right? We become involved, we put our hand into the soil, and that gives us the data, right, that we need to investigate. So that would probably, so kind of basically the and experiencing how in regenerative agriculture, everything is revolving around increasing the quality of the soil prepared me for the work that we do today, you and I and many others kind of who are listening to this conversation, which is essentially, as I would put it, improving the quality of the social soil, right? What is the social soil? It's kind of the quality of our relationships and the quality of our awareness or our consciousness. And you mentioned theory U. So what is theory U in one sentence? It's basically awareness-based systems change, or it's consciousness-based systems change. It's based on the principle that you cannot change a system unless you shift consciousness. And so how do you shift consciousness? So that's what we investigated for the past 20 years, and by making systems sense and see themselves, right? So, and the sensing part, right, which is kind of the feeling it and the experiencing it is a critical part of that process. So the farm is, I would say, number one. Number two is the social movements, like the environmental movements, late 70s or early 80s, then the peace movement. And I would say the third one is, so we are like in this action research and also semi-academic context here. And so I am in Germany, as you know, back then you needed to go to the army, right? So I refused to go to the army. You get a trial and then you do a social service. After that was done, I went to the first university I ever attended, which is Free University of Berlin. And I had complete decoupled hopes about what a university could be, a place of real knowledge and true change and so lots of things. So that was probably, in hindsight, honestly, probably one of the biggest disappointments in my life, just because my illusions were so, you know, accumulated before. And so it was somewhat an experience of disillusionment. But in the first year I attended, I more or less lost soul, right, in the Free University of Berlin. I attended one lecture from one guy. He was a visiting professor from Norway. His name was Johan Galtung, the founder of Peace Research as a Science. And so he, and known for his theory of structural violence and other things, so he had a complete different approach to science. So science for him was not kind of the description of laws, right, of invariances, but his approach to science was defined as seeking and breaking of invariances. In other words, exploring the condition under which stuff can change, right? Rather than explaining kind of wrapping around of explanations why the reality is the way it is, right? So, and that approach and seeing, it's really interesting, right? It was a rather depressing place, I would say. You see one person, right? One single faculty member. He wasn't even, he was just a visiting faculty member. And that is enough to ignite a flame that has never died since. It's so, I think it's an interesting story because those of us, because I would say any one of us can be that for any other person, right? So for me, it happens in a university. In this one lecture series there. But, you know, for other people, it happens in other places, right? And so, but particularly for those of us who have some role in a university, like you and I, that is a particular reminder. So that was a big turning point for me. I saw one single person who basically used science with an intention, right, to make the world a better place, right? Kind of to, for development. And in his case, it was really peace research, right? Peace with peaceful means, inspired by Gandhi, right? And later, I ended up you know, together with him and with another fellow student who now is my wife and partner to organize a peace studies around the world trip, right, in 1989, when the Berlin Wall came down. And so on. So I would say that's number three. Number four is I went then to a small private university, and that was founded by the captains of the West German industry, kind of the big guys, basically by saying, look, we need to reimagine university and business schools. You know, you guys should do it, right? So it was kind of basically in the way you innovate the business schools is not that you go into a big ship and try to steer that around. You just create a new one. So, and I was lucky enough to end up with the first year of students there. And the interesting thing, the best thing, back then I've complained, right, in my mind. But in hindsight, the best thing was there was nothing there. There was nothing. There wasn't even, you know, not even a library, right? Nothing other than really high expectation, right? The expectation of the public and the German industry and kind of a lot of, you know, high level visibility was we are going to reinvent this. We are going to move from theory and praxis integration. We'll integrate philosophy and epistemology into reimagining, you know, blah, 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 all these things. And they had a really, got a really gifted founding dean, Ekkehard Kappler, right? Kind of, so who was a genius in putting students into the driver's seat. Because what he basically said is, look, guys, this is our aspiration, basically rematching the whole damn thing. You can do it. Go out and do it. So it's basically, I mean, it was at first everyone was looking at each other. So does he really mean that? And then so, and but as a young person to have the challenge, right? So we were placed in companies. We could do real in-company projects. There was really this aspiration of bringing deep reflection into the core assumptions of economic theory and so on and so forth. So to really have these expectations and have a dean, which is university leadership, that is trusting the students to do it. Obviously, in hindsight, you could say, well, that was the only chance they had because there was nothing much of faculty, amazing faculty around and so on. But that was really the gift. And I'm not saying that is ideal, right? Obviously, in any kind of university, if you have really great faculty, that's something everyone loves, right? And for a good reason. But what's often missing is to turn the core challenge. It's basically the blank canvas, right? And to challenge the students to really reimagine what they want to do and activate their own agency by creating conferences, by moving into companies, by doing action learning, and by co-shaping the space that we call university or business school or school of economics. And that was certainly the community of students that we formed back then. That was another core inspiration. And the last thing was really going to MIT then. And I realized, so I had then written a book essentially about reflective modernization of capitalism as a revolution from within. No one ever read it. So it was, it was in German. And what I realized is I could talk a big deal about transformation of the economy and learning societies and so on. But was I really helpful and useful in helping the very change makers who were supposed to do all these things in the field? And the answer was sobering, right? So, and realizing that really made me go to MIT, to Boston, to join back what was back then the MIT Learning Center headed by Peter Senge, but also people like Ed Schein and Chris Argyris and others involved in, because in that case, research was conducted together with companies, a dozen of companies, through learning by doing, right? And through really running practical experiments and applying systems thinking to the real challenges that we face. So ever since, basically, you know, that's where I got stuck. I'm still there, right? So fast forward, so I'm still there. I never managed to move on. But what has changed since, I would say, is a broadening and deepening of what back then was organizational learning. So broadening means it's the whole system, it's all the different stakeholders and sectors in society that need to be involved. And deepening means you really need to get more personal. You need to connect to the level of consciousness of every single person if you really want to create the level of deep change that the current polycrisis is calling for. So those are some of the context factors that put me on the path that I have been on.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I'm April Hardy, crime victim advocate trained by NOVA, founder of In Case I'm Murdered, and recent recipient of a $12,500 grant for intimate partner homicide prevention work. I've experienced domestic violence from both sides, as the employee whose performance suffered, and as the business owner who absorbed every cost directly. This is the Safe Work Advantage podcast that helps HR professionals and business leaders recognize risk, reduce liability, and protect their people.
Wonderful, wonderful. Thank you so much. And it gives context also, I think, to the deeper and the broader, because it also showcases your personal story and your personal transformation or learning in the context of what you're doing right now, right? Which is, and maybe you can share a little bit, which groups you're working with in terms of system transformation, the way that you're describing it. And if you will, would you want to share some of your updated thinking? I think you sort of have a new book out, and it would be great to sort of see what is your sort of update as of now, having done so much work in so many areas, so many domains with so many people.
Yeah. So I think maybe that's a good good entry point, the updated thinking, and then I can. It's particularly interesting because I haven't quite, you know, I just finished the book. It just came out a few days ago. So I haven't really thought about that, that methodically. But, and then also talk about a few examples. The updated, I already shared the reference point, right? So basically a theory U is awareness-based systems change. You could say it's deep systems change, which means essentially that to change a system, you need to shift consciousness, right? From an ego structure to an ecostructure, ecosystem awareness to ecosystem awareness, or kind of you could say from a silo view to a systems view. And how do you do that? That's basically the U process and all the methods and tools around that. Now, in classical systems thinking for the past 70, 80 years or so, we have been using often the iceberg model, right? It's the distinction between symptoms visible at the top, and then there's also the other 90% are not visible to the eye. And what is leadership from an iceberg or systems thinking point of view? It is understanding and addressing the deeper root issues, right, that we are dealing with. And while that, you know, I have been using that myself for quite a bit and still am, and it has been used in systems thinking, complexity theory for almost 100 years. So I also often thought that in the age of the poly crisis, kind of that this unique moment we are in, isn't there perhaps a metaphor that is more relevant to the current moment? And to me, it was the first context that I was born into, right? And I grew up on kind of a regenerative farm, a biodynamic farm in northern Germany. The source of inspiration there, which, you know, led me in this most recent book to describe that as a social field, right? And the social field is basically the distinction between the social systems at the top, right, at the visible part, and the social soil as the non-visible part of the system or of the field, if you want. And so social soil then is quality of awareness and quality of relationships. And just as the farmer needs tools, right? That's also something I saw at home, right? Kind of, and you see in every regenerative farm, you need tools to cultivate the soil, right? It used to be the plow, right, in conventional architecture. Mm-hmm. Now it's the chisel plow. It's kind of other tools that you use for non-tilling agricultural cultivation work, but it's still cultivation work. And I think that is very, very akin to what we do in cultivating the social field, right? Because we need practices, right? It's not, what is the problem in our field? It's a knowing doing gap. That's the problem. We know what the problems are. We know what the solutions are. Is it happening? No. Why not? Because we are not embodying and applying the practices, right? We need to cultivate the social soil. We really need a the cultivation of the social soil is the embodying kind of these practices in a way that are shifting awareness and relationships, right, from transactional to more transformative and regenerative. And that's really what a good teacher does. That's what a good leader does. That's what a good parent does, right? That's kind of what we do when we do our work well. And so that's the new book, essentially, describing seven practices that, you know, now does it have to be exactly these sevens? I mean, so you could, it doesn't really matter kind of how you call them, but what does matter is whether or not you have such type of practices. And that's why we go in a more specific. And the first one, just to mention one, I mean, obviously one that I have seen in almost any intervention or process or project I was ever part of, the transformation of listening, the shifting of listening from towards the deeper, more generative spaces of listening and holding space for essentially for conversations where something new is being born and becomes present. That's kind of really core. And that's also what I, as a university faculty member, right? It is astonishing how fast, if you apply a method and practice, how fast people can change their level of listening. So I'm teaching at MIT a six-week class, like just H1, the first half of the fall term. And that, for many years, that has happened for almost everyone who does that. It doesn't happen by reading a book. You need to apply these practices. You need the small group work. You need to do that you need a review process. So it does require practice. It does require community. But when you do that, within a month or two, it's amazing, all right? Because if you would have asked me like 20 years ago, oh, listening and conversation and awareness, well, that's kind of, this is deep stuff, right? It takes forever to form that and even longer, right, to shift that. And if you do so, it's expensive and painful. And so not true. None of that is true. It doesn't take forever, but it takes discipline. It takes practice. And that's exactly what in any kind of university setting, right, we have the opportunity for, because it kind of it has this repetitive weekly structure. And so that's one. But so here's an example of an awareness. So the first awareness, the first practice we call becoming aware. So what can exemplify this becoming aware? So if you take a stick, you throw it in front of a dog, everyone knows what's going to happen, right? The dog is going after the stick, right? Jumping after the stick. So all the attention is on the stick. If you take the same stick, you throw it in front of a lion, here's what the lion is going to do. He's turning his head and looking straight at you. So the lion's attention goes from the object to the source where the stick is originating from. And then you can ask, okay, how often am I in my work, right? How often are we in our organization or even in society responding to disruption in the mode of the dog, right? Kind of someone is dangling an incentive in front of you, right? And you are like, some disruption that happens, and predictably, here's how you react against that, right? And how often are we responding to disruption in the mode of the dog? And how often are we responding to disruption in society today in the mode of the lion, right? Suspending the habitual response and turning the attention from the object to the source. And that, needless to say, is the essence of systems thinking. And that is, you could say, it's the meta practice, right? But it has to do with awareness. It has to do with how we pay attention. And it has to do with how we align attention and intention.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Sarah Beth Herman, a five-time CEO and host of the podcast No Silver Spoons. This show is for leaders, entrepreneurs, and people building something meaningful without shortcuts. We talk about leadership, mindset, business growth, and the real lessons that come from doing hard things really well. And if you're in the dental industry, you'll hear a few episodes that speak directly to that world too. Because no matter your field, leadership is leadership. Listen to No Silver Spoons wherever you get your podcast.
And you could say, so it took me 600 pages to describe the theory U process initially, right? That's ridiculously long, needless to say. But I would say today I would describe the same process with just three words. Attention, agency. And those are kind of the three aspects of the U, right? Going down of the left-hand side of the U is attention. The bottom of the U, kind of connecting to the emerging future, is intention. And then agency is moving that into action. So the double clicking on these three words, the summary is this. Attention, if truly deepened, gives rise to intention, gives rise to a sense of the ours, gives rise to the future that is looking at us because it depends on us to manifest. Right? So that it you know, moves that into our sphere of awareness. Intention, truly clarified, begins to catalyze agency. So that's that's kind of another way. It's more like simplification, you could say, or a crystallization of the you process. So how has the thinking evolved? Well, one is from the iceberg model. So those are like three trajectories. So you can say first kind of the underlying metaphor has shifted from the iceberg to the social soil, right? Mm-hmm. And the practices that allow us to cultivate the social soil. Secondly, the you process, right? Describing it really in a more essentialized version with those three words, attention, intention, and agency. And then I would say the third aspect is that in the later part of the Theory U book, you know, it was there in the beginning already, but of course no one read it, right? And it's 600. So who is reading like 600 pages? No one does. But the Theory U book is basically two things, right? It's the cycle of presencing, which is basically opening the mind, opening the heart, opening the will. And then from that deepened connection to source, to intention, moving into a different type of agency. So that's the you process. But then the cycle of, or the field of presencing. But then there is, and we saw a huge amplification of that over the past decade or so, politically and geopolitically, there is this cycle of absencing, right? Which is about a freeze reaction, right? There's kind of a disruption that happens, and I respond to that because it's overwhelming me with a freeze reaction of my mind, of my heart, of my will, right? Kind of, it's kind of a closing and turning away from reality in order to protect myself, right? It's mm-hmm. kind of a, you know, you could say it's a trauma type of response to being overwhelmed by a situation. And so that gives, rather than moving into seeing, sensing, presencing, you move into denial and desensing and absencing, basically disconnecting, right, to what's happening around you and also disconnecting from your deeper sense of purpose. So in the original rendering of Theory U, presencing looked pretty much, I mean, the way I presented it visually as the opposite of absencing. And yet, engaging with these realities more deeply, I, in the new book, came up with something new, which is presencing is not the opposite of absencing, because that would be just another way of polarizing, right? So us versus them and so on. And don't we have already too much of that, right? No, I would say presencing is the middle way between two extreme forms of absencing. So let me explain. So for example, in open mind, in other words, it's a more Taoist version of presencing, right? When you really understand presencing, you understand it as the middle way. And so I will give you a couple of examples real quick. So when you look at the open mind, right? So when the mind is, what is the opposite of that? It's the closed mind. So what is a form of a closed mind? Well, it's kind of, you know, let's say kind of the voice of judgment, right? Kind of, so that's kind of the standard version that we, but there's also on the opposite of the extreme. So there's like, you're too sure about things, right? How they are, but there's an opposite version of that as well. And that is the voice of doubt, right? Mm-hmm. And interestingly, the climate denial industry, who with $500 million, right? What did they try to do? Not counterproof climate science. No, they sowing doubt. That was their strategy, right? So there's like, those are the two extremes. So doubt means there's nothing I can ever, everyone has their own opinion. How can we know anything, right? We can't, right? It's just kind of some scientists say this, other scientists say that. How can we know, right? How can I know? I can't. So that's the opposite. you're too sure about yourself, right? Voice of judgment, right? You have no openness to let new data in, or whatever the data tells you, kind of you're like over diminishing, right? So that's on the level of the mind. The open mind is neither falling victim to the voice of doubt, over diminish yourself, or falling victim to the voice of judgment. But it's the middle way, right? Staying open, right? And having your questions and, you know, and kind of confirming the data, right? And kind of getting ground under your feet, right? Kind of coming up with a judgment that is appropriate to the reality that you're dealing with and that can co-evolve with a situation that's changing. On the level of emotions, the open heart. So what are the two extremes, right? Too much is the voice of hate. It's basically the othering. Mm-hmm. Othering without, you know, extreme emotions connected. And on the opposite, we have despair.
Mm.
The voice of despair, because everything is so... I'm so insignificant, right? To that, there's nothing I can do. And of course, the othering, right, in a polarized society and the despair are massive forces that through social media are amplified, right, with a $1 trillion industry every day. Now, what is open-heartedness, what the whole you process is about? It is neither one nor the other, but it's the middle way. So it is kind of that it's the capacity to engage with emotionally difficult situations without getting derailed, right? Because basically, once you move into hating and othering, you're derailing yourself, right? Derailing, what I mean with derailing is you're disconnecting, right? You're no longer in touch with what's actually going on. You're just kind of projecting your internal mechanisms. And that's the problem, right? It's the othering. So again, open-heartedness is the middle way between those two ways of over-expanding or over-diminishing. And then on the level of the will, again, the same thing, right? So what is, if we go too much, it's fanaticism, right? That's basically kind of, all acts of terrorism. But, it's like all acts of extremism, right? Kind of people get fanatical, right? It's group thing. It's like, so you're enslaved, right, by some imperatives that are no longer in dialogue with you.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other side, it is something that we all know extremely well, which is the voice of fear, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what does the voice of fear do? It is killing your agency, right? Because it puts you into insignificance. So what is open will? It's the capacity to, it's your capacity to let go and let come, right? So let go means to not be fanatically enslaved by your yesterday's solution, but also not falling victim to the voice of fear that makes you hold on to things that are no longer serving you, right? So this letting go and letting come is really the process at the bottom of the U where we need to trust the universe, right? Mm. That this other reality that you talked about, in the title of your show here, right? So is really coming from a good source, right? So you need to trust the universe. If you're not trusting the universe, you can't end up in a good place, right? You're making yourself much smaller than you really are.
Mm.
But as human beings, we are not really small. Kind of, we have this capacity to grow into this field of possibility that has no necessity, but that can come into reality kind of through our own agency if we cultivate this deeper level of connection. So I would say kind of those are three distinct ways of how Theory U has been evolving and clarifying over the past 2 decades.
Wonderful, wonderful. And I hear one of the key things you mentioned is sort of like this, well, first connectedness, but also the possibility of significance. We can maybe speak to that because you're sort of saying like, okay, you have agency, you have possibility, you have the reality open to you to be the change that you want to see in the world, right? Whatever that is for you. It also matches very much with many spiritual traditions, the language that you're using. And in many ways, I think it's something that people intuitively can grasp onto. I remember you distinctly saying, like, the biggest challenge is not that we don't have solutions for that. The biggest challenge that we're facing as humanity is that we're either disconnected or we feel we can't do anything about the situation. So I think that's what Pope Francis and others have described as this spiritual divide, as this disconnect from your own humanity, from the creator, from the source, as you say. What do you see as some of the examples that give you grounded hope in that space? That yes, we can do this. You say even just in 6 weeks or a short amount of time, people can actually reconnect intentionally. They can actually get into a space of possibility for themselves, of agency, of creating the system-wide solution. Is there anything that particularly sticks out for you that you can share?
Yeah. So, I mean, just to connect with the framing of your question. So it's very true. I mean, I think kind of that is pretty much the situation today, that we know a lot about the ecological divide and we know a lot about the social divide. And in both of these cases, what the problems are, what the principal solutions are, but we are not embodying and activating agency and implementing these solutions at a rate that is called for. The third divide, the spiritual divide, is really the stumbling block, right? And we have essentially today, according to a UN survey last year, 68% of people report about massive loss of collective agency. So basically, they say what happens in their community, the collective decision making, is disconnected. They feel completely disconnected with that. It has nothing to do, their voice doesn't feature in that. It has nothing to do with their own intentionality. So 2 out of 3. And yet, almost the same number, 69%, also say that personally they would be willing to sacrifice part of their income, their personal income, to address climate change. So we have positive intentionality on this planet today in abundance, but we have a huge gap in translating this positive individual intentionality into collective agency. That's the gap. And that has everything to do with leadership. It has everything to do with learning. It has everything to do with reimagining the university, the business school, and the school of the future. Mm-hmm. Because if we don't address this knowing-doing gap, right, this loss of agency, we'll get stuck in the patterns of the past. And AI is the safest mechanism to freeze that to a degree that it will be very, very difficult to get out of. So the call of our time could not be more clear. And that is certainly, so your question was, sorry, remind me. So your question
was. No, I mean, that you're responding to that question. And like, what gives you grounded hope?
Grounded hope.
Right. What's the examples that you see that maybe come to your mind when maybe you are entering some form of despair or surrounded by people with that disconnect?
Yeah. So what gives me grounded hope? I am, I must say, it sounds a little strange, right? Because I'm living in a country that is marching into autocracy. I'm living on a planet where, as a species, we are continuing our march towards self-destruction as an organized civilization, right? That's kind of the trajectory. Anyone who does not see this direction of travel is in denial, really, of what's going on. And yet, personally, I'm not despaired. I'm not. And why is that? I don't think it's because of delusion, and I also don't think it's about denial, but I would say it's grounded hope. I wouldn't say I'm optimistic, but I would say I'm hopeful. And the grounded hope is because I have experienced in so many places the unfolding of a story that I believe is the most significant story and most least well-told story of our time, which is the story of an awakening of a new awareness that starts with that basically pretty much everyone, or like 2 out of 3 people, agree on that the current system is broken. We need something, which, by the way, is one of the reasons why we have the current government in the US, right? Because the previous government didn't do any more than defending the system, right? That was in itself also broken, right? So there's the new awareness starts with that there is something, we are on a profoundly on the wrong path, right? Which is a path to self-destruction, essentially, if you add up where we are going, and that something different is necessary, and that this something different needs to not only, it's not a political change. It's not a change that's just political, right? Or it's just kind of on environmental law or the other, right? But it's something that has to do with a shift of awareness, a shift of consciousness, and that, you know, is maybe also has to do with a more post-materialistic way of looking at human beings and organizing learning, education, and society. I think kind of something that is transcending current polarizations in a way that what we really need to do is we need to cultivate that deeper social soil, right? Not only in terms of the relationships and the common that currently exist, but also the future that we want to create together. And I see the beginnings of that in so many places. Mm-hmm. When, you know, a line that has always inspired me, it's an evocative line, but it's also something really I have seen with my own eyes happening. It's this. It's attributed to Ilya Prigozhin, the Nobel laureate and chemist. When a system is far from equilibrium, small islands of coherence in a sea of chaos have the capacity to uplift the entire system to a higher order. So what he's basically proposing is kind of the principle of bifurcation points in nonlinear systems so that small differences can have a huge impact when a system is kind of moving from one equilibrium to another one. And what is the smallest unit of, you know, the smallest island of coherence, right? The smallest unit, you know, it's me, it's you, right? It's the way how I pay attention. It's the way how we conduct a conversation. It's it happens in kind of the quality of the social side, the quality of our attention and intention, kind of that gives rise to a different type of agency or a different type of conversation. And that makes it very practical. We both have been long enough around to see kind of there have been so many approaches, the silver bullets, right? Whether that's new technologies or kind of, you know, or whether it's kind of a new type of money or kind of business legislation or something else. And, you know, there's some truth to all of these things, right? But we, over the years, I think if we have learned anything, it's this. The only way this will work is this. It takes all of us, everyone, right? Each and everyone has a role to play. So it's not kind of, it's not something that I can watch other people do, but each of us has to. So I would say this current moment, for me, kind of the most important question that I'm living with right now is this, considering how much of the future hangs in balance, right? Because we are like the generation that just through no accomplishment just happens to be around in this moment where the future, where we'll be going as a species and also as a planet, where so much of that is hanging in balance, right? And so considering that, this is the question that comes up for me. What if this is the moment I was born for? What if this is the moment you were born? What if this is the moment we have been born for, right? As a community of change makers that through everything we went through in the years past, have been prepared for this moment to rise to the occasion. And yes, it may not be easy, right? And yes, it may be dealing with your fear and you know, and your biases and habits of othering and the ones that I have as well. We all have these issues. Yeah. Right? Mm-hmm. But that's exactly what leadership is, right? I mean, if leadership were easy, we would have an app already for it, right? We don't have an app. And so we are kind of change making in this current moment, right, where deep change is really called for is difficult. And that's exactly why no one can do it alone. And we need each other to rise to the occasion. But that's, and I see that in many places. Because I see that happening in many small communities. I see these islands of coherence, right? That's what you can form in your classroom as an educator. Mm-hmm. That's what you can form in your own, let's say you have a morning practice, a little meditation practice, mm-hmm. where you try to focus your attention on your intention, what you want your life to be in service of, right? And so that's when you listen to another person, when you conduct a difficult or not so or more enjoyable conversation, whatever it is. That's kind of where we can create these little islands of coherence. And so the key for that is practices. The key for that is finding your partners, because no one can do this alone. You don't need a big group, but you need a few people around mm-hmm. you that you can connect with. And then, of course, we need to connect with each other on a larger scale. And that's where we currently have like the presencing series, for example. It's a free online thing. It's kind of also available as an archive mm-hmm. after the fact. But we have, in a few weeks, 5,000 people kind of sign up, kind of that join these sessions, that connect with other people in breakout groups and so on. I would say the cycle of absencing, kind of the freeze reaction of the mind, heart, will. We have a $1 trillion industry that is kind of amplifying that cycle every single day. Mm-hmm. What do we have on the other side, right? We have just as many. I would say we have more instances of presencing, right, of these islands of coherence. Mm-hmm. What don't we have? Amplification mechanism, right? Mm-hmm. There is, the funding structure we have is ridiculous. It's broken, right, and 1,000 pieces. It's not coherent and so on. There's kind of a lot to be done there. And yet, a lot is happening there. A lot is kind of, beginning to self-organize across the planet. And being connected with some of these in Latin America, in Southeast Asia, in Africa, in Europe, here in North America, gives me a lot of hope. Because mm-hmm. What I learned through these experiences, what's missing is not the good intention. What's missing is not the right people. All of that is there. What's missing is the quality of connection. It's the quality of the holding places. Mm-hmm. It's the quality of the holding spaces that we create for each other. That's what we have here for. That's what we can pull off together. It's very doable, and it's beginning to happen in a few places. That is my reason of Grounded Hope.
Wonderful. Otto, I thank you so much. This is giving me reason for hope. I'm going to go teach now, and it's a final class, and I feel newly invigorated with this conversation. I'm just seeing the students also actually practicing many of those things, and it's sort of, I think it's showing up, and the moment is the moment to face the possibility of us being the solution, right? And so in many ways, I thank you for just re-presencing us also to your thinking newly and the way to bring it into that context, into life. And I really appreciate your time, the way that you hold the space and give us that opportunity to just see what is possible. And I think that's the reality, right? That's the reality of what's possible. And we can definitely do better than this, what we're sort of seeing right now as the breakdown of the system. So thanks again for the time. And I'm
thank you, Michael.
To further conversation.
When you publish this, because mm-hmm. I think it's...